to mandate insurance for individuals, that we have to get insurance or be fined or worse, diminishes our freedom and I think potentially violates the 10th Amendment.
Governor Parnell explains his opposition to the health care bill. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, the 25th of March. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Sitkins turn out to watch an annual spring spectacle.
I think the thing is, you know, there's a lot of money out there to see how one boat can get as much as they can and see how much money they can get.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Wells Fargo, providing financial tools and resources for purchasing a home or planning for the future. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. And by the Association of Alaska School Boards. Parents that read to their children foster early learning and educational development for children and youth. Information at aasb.org.
President Obama may have signed major health care legislation into law 2 days ago, but debate and hostility continues in the nation's capital. The Senate passed today a bill of fixes to the health care legislation on a vote of 56-43, despite Republican attempts to stall passage or derail it by introducing a series of amendments. Democrats said they wouldn't vote for them because they would hold up their bill. Republicans designed some of the amendments to make Democrats look bad for voting against them. Republican Senator Lisa Murkowski contributed to the effort with an amendment to keep high-earning Americans from paying more in Medicare taxes because of inflation.
This is about an $86 billion tax hike. So what my amendment does, again, is very simple. I aim to contain the damage that we will see by indexing for inflation the wage thresholds for those subject to the tax increase.
It predictably failed along party lines. Democratic Senator Max Baucus of Montana spoke afterward and said while it's a good idea, he thinks it goes about it the wrong way by taking money from the stimulus funds. Republicans also shut down unrelated hearings yesterday all over Capitol Hill because of the health care fight. That didn't sit well with members of the Senate Armed Services Committee taking testimony on military health issues, including Alaska Democratic Senator Mark Begich. He urged Democratic Chairman Jim Webb of Virginia and top Republican Lindsey Graham of South Carolina to keep working.
Can we, with or without it, can we just continue on and just have it as a non-hearing hearing? Make the rules as we go is my rule. Why not? I mean, these guys have...
I suppose we could go into informal conversation if they cancel the hearing at 11. I don't know what that would do to the official transcript of the hearing or that sort of thing, but
I want to hear what they got to say, but we'll figure it out.
Let's proceed.
With the support of Republican Graham, they continued the hearing, but not all exchanges on Capitol Hill this week have been so bipartisan. House Democrats have received threatening and hostile messages for their health care vote and bricks thrown through office windows. Members of both sides are blaming the other party for roiling tensions. Former Alaska Governor Sarah Palin was criticized for her anti-Democratic Party messages online, like "Don't retreat, reload," and putting a map on her fundraising page with crosshairs over districts she plans to target this fall in midterm elections. At the state capitol in Juneau, Governor Sean Parnell spoke about his concerns with the new health care legislation. Parnell says he thinks it is unconstitutional because of the provision that requires individuals to buy health insurance.
The national government does not enact mandatory, motorcycle helmet laws. They don't have a national mandatory auto insurance law. Those are left to the states under the 10th Amendment. And to mandate insurance for individuals, that we have to get insurance or be fined or worse, diminishes our freedom and I think potentially violates the 10th Amendment.
But Parnell says he's not one to make quick decisions without being fully informed on an issue. He says he'll wait until the Attorney General has finished an exhaustive review of the legislation before deciding how to proceed. A new piece of legislation aimed at resolving a constitutional case against the state of Alaska has passed its first hurdle. Senate Bill 237 would create a new funding formula that would require the legislature to pay for rural school construction every year. From member station KYUK in Bethel, Shane Iverson has more.
It was 10 years ago that the Superior Court ruled the state's method for funding school construction violated the Education Clause and Equal Protection Clause of the Alaska Constitution. Since then, the state has increased spending in rural areas, but the formula is still exactly the same. Bethel Senator Lyman Hoffman is hopeful that will change this session if Senate Bill 237 clears the legislature.
If we can get that done, that's going to be landmark legislation for rural Alaska.
The bill would require the legislature to put $40 million into a fund every year designated for rural school construction projects. The fund would also have a $125 million cap to ensure it's spent regularly. Hoffman sits as co-chair of the Senate Finance Committee. He says he's been urging for years to put an end to the old formula.
It's time to stop it, and we don't want to put anything through the Finance Committee that is unconstitutional. We should be supporting our Constitution.
The bill is now headed to that Finance Committee. It already breezed through the Senate Education Committee, and there was a public hearing on it this week. When it gets to the House, Bethel Representative Bob Herron says it stands a good chance. He and two other rural Democratic representatives, Bryce Edgman and Reggie Jewell, are members of the predominantly Republican majority. And fellow rural lawmaker Neil Foster of Nome and Woody Salmon sit on the House Finance Committee. Bethel Representative Bob Herron.
So the perfect storm is coming, and we have a great opportunity.
Lawmakers hope the legislation will not just resolve the Casile case, but also help get funding on track for the neediest sites in the state. Schools in Alakanuk, Kipnuk, Quigilinuk, and Napusquiak are operating between 200 and 300% student capacity. Governor Sean Parnell visited many of those schools earlier this session in a show of support. Senator Hoffman says the governor will have the final say on the strength of the legislation.
The biggest hurdle, I believe, is going to be final negotiations on getting the governor to sign it once the bill is in front of him.
Reporting from Bethel, I'm Shane Iverson.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a mountaineer fails to reach the summit but finds success in the long journey.
I just have the utmost admiration for the man because, you know, to me, he's a backcountry traveler and a mountaineer.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com.
Shell Oil's drilling plans for this summer in the Chukchi and Beaufort Seas are not yet fully approved, so it's not certain that they will be bringing vessels and business to Unalaska. Shell purchased the leases for drilling in the Chukchi Sea under the Bush administration's five-year lease sale plan. The legality of that plan is still under consideration by the Court of Appeals, which is awaiting more scientific information from the Department of Interior. Shell Oil spokesman Curtis Smith says the court should get the information on March 29th, but even after they receive it, it's unclear if Shell will be able to proceed. The company also needs two more air permits for the drilling rig. If the permits are approved, then the public has 30 days to comment on them.
And then if somebody has an issue with any of those air permits, they'll have to be challenged and brought to the Environmental Appeals Board. And if it does go to the Environmental Appeals Board, each separate permit, and frankly, it's likely that they will, there's no real timeline for when the EAB will rule on those permits.
Smith says it's not certain that Shell will be able to start exploratory drilling in 2010.
As I say, we're still planning for success in 2010, but it's also fair to say that our windows are getting squeezed slightly, and we need some things to fall into our favor.
If the company can drill, they will use the port of Dutch Harbor for pre-season loading, in-season resupply, and off-season unloading. If Shell can move forward, they will start with two exploratory wells in the Beaufort Sea, then drill three in the Chukchi. The information would be analyzed over the winter to see if there is a commercially viable oil or natural gas source in either area. Many environmental and native groups are opposed to the drilling plans in the Northern Seas because of their potentially negative impacts on the ecosystems and centuries-old subsistence practices. The Alaska House Fisheries Committee and the Senate Resources Committee held a hearing last week at which they discussed the state regulations and statutes related to the permitting and development of large-scale mineral developments in Alaska. KDLG's Mike Mason listened in and has this story.
Friday's hearing was in response to a letter from the Alaska Board of Fisheries asking for a review of the permitting process in the state of Alaska. Specifically, the board is concerned that development of the Pebble Mine could harm the fish resources in the Bristol Bay watershed. The hearing was called by District 37 State Representative Bryce Edgman from Dillingham, who chairs the House Fisheries Committee. During Tuesday morning's legislative call-in program on KDLG, Edgman assessed what was accomplished during the hearing.
It was a fairly low-key, maybe in some respects uneventful in terms of any revelations or new information coming forward. But it was a successful hearing, and that we were able to further the imprint with a lot of legislators that the Pebble Mine is bigger, it's different, it requires special attention.
In a constituent newsletter issued on Saturday, Representative Edgman noted that the hearing demonstrated that there are many unanswered questions in terms of the state's ability to protect the most valuable salmon fishery in the world. The hearing included invited guests that were asked a series of questions. Ed Fogels is the director of the Office of Project Management and Permitting within the Alaska Department of Natural Resources. He stressed that the Pebble Partnership has not yet applied for permits for the project, which means that many of the specific details of the project are still unknown.
And we have not received any permit applications to the state, so I think everyone needs to understand that there's a level of detail that we don't have. And it is all about the details. The details, such as the geochemistry of the waste rock products, those drive water quality for us. And to answer the question, in my view, the biggest risks are with water quality.
Despite what is unknown at the moment, Fogels testified that the state has a system in place that would do a good job of reviewing the permit applications for the Pebble Mine. At the heart of Friday's hearing was the proposed Pebble Mine near Iliamna Lake, and the company looking at developing the mine is the Pebble Partnership, which was represented by CEO John Shively. He confirmed that water quality will be among the challenges that must be dealt with if the Pebble deposit is to be developed.
Obviously, the prospect is a big prospect. We've never shied away from that. The issue is not how big the prospect is. The issue is how big a mine we're going to permit. And I've said, I think, a number of times publicly that although the current resource, probably you could mine for 80 to 100 years, it is not our intent to permit the entire resource.
The Pebble Partnership has repeatedly said they will not be submitting any permit applications in 2010. Representative Edgman confirmed that there is talk of including funding in the state capital budget to obtain an independent review of not just the permitting process in Alaska, but also the known and probable environmental and socioeconomic consequences of a large-scale mineral extraction project in the Bristol Bay watershed. In Dillingham, I'm Mike Mason.
The first opening of the Sitka Sound sacro herring fishery netted 5,000 tons of herring. That's the preliminary data from Fish and Game Area Management Biologist Dave Gordon after Wednesday's harvest near the Gavansky and Siganaka Islands. At the negotiated price of $550 per ton, Wednesday's catch has an estimated value of $2.8 million, all from 1 hour and 25 minutes of fishing. Gordon says the fleet will likely stand down for a while to allow processors to work through the 5,000 tons of fish.
I think if we harvested more in the 3,000-ton range, we'd probably sit for a day, even with that amount, and be ready to go the following day. But with this amount of harvest, we'll be sitting at least 2 days, I think.
The harvest from the first opening is a little more than a quarter of the overall harvest limit. That limit is more than 18,000 tons, which has a total estimated worth of about $10 million. The opening of Sitka's Sack Row herring fishery often brings spectators to the shoreline. The fact that Wednesday's opening took place 10 minutes after 5 o'clock and under sunny skies probably didn't hurt. KCAW's Ed Ronco reports.
As the fleet moved north toward the first opening of the 2010 herring fishery, so did Sitka motorists, who parked their vehicles on either side of Halibut Point Road, as they themselves sat on metal guardrails with binoculars and cameras at the ready. In Sitka, this might be as close as it gets to a traffic jam. No bother, though, cars could still get through, although even those drivers slowed down and craned their neck to catch a glimpse of the fleet working offshore.
We have boats, but not like this.
Sima Butte is here from San Diego, California, with her fiancé, Jim Miller. Miller is flying one of the dozen or so spotter planes circling overhead. Butte says her fiancé's plane is blue and white, but so far she hasn't been able to spot it. Still, there she is, camera in one hand, VHF radio in the other, 1,800 miles up the coast from home.
That's how much I love him. I'm in love. That's what love does to you.
She says she's never seen anything like this fishery where people, like her fiancé, have to be ready to go on a moment's notice.
And we were walking to lunch, actually, and they called us, and he ran, took off running.
So when they say it's time to go, it's time to go.
It's time to go, exactly.
This is the first opening, so you haven't seen, like, everything yet. But what are you going to tell people back home?
I got pictures to prove what I have to say. They're not going to believe me.
Butte has been in Sitka about 4 days. Mike Hirai has been in Sitka for 35 years. And at the moment, he's keeping watch over his grandson, Kai.
I was in boots.
That's Kai there, and he's really, really excited.
Big helicopter!
Helicopter!
Hirai, however, says he's not really astonished by the fishery anymore. Still, that doesn't stop him from coming down and taking a look at what's going on.
I think the thing is, you know, there's a lot of money out there to see how one boat can get as much as he can and see how much money they can get. And it's kind of fun to say, well, you know, I saw that boat set that net, you know, and so on. So it's great.
As it turns out, the people along Halibut Point Road on Wednesday didn't actually see many sets being made. Most of the fishing happened on the other side of Big Gavansky Island, out of view. But this was just the first opening, and there's still about 75% of this year's harvest limit out there. And you can bet that more fishing means more impromptu community gatherings along stretches of coastline. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Ed Ronco.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska, working shoulder to shoulder with Alaskan businesses for nearly a century. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender. And by ACS. With Android on ACS, an app is available to listen to NPR programming on your phone. Complete details at acsalaska.com.
Some electric utility customers in Alaska and Kentucky have joined forces to protest federal loan guarantees for coal-fired power plants. Ratepayers' alliances representing Fairbanks, the Matanuska Valley, and Homer, and similar organizations in Kentucky, are working with watchdog groups to protest U.S. Department of Agriculture's issuance of $900 million in lien accommodations for a coal-burning power plant in the southern state. Nancy Kuhn with the Golden Valley Electric Association Ratepayers Alliance says she's worried ratepayers could end up footing the bill if the agency approves loans for the startup of the Healy Clean Coal Plant. And she's concerned about an upcoming annual meeting vote on whether the Interior utility should eliminate a $460 million debt ceiling from the co-op's bylaws.
If we can't borrow money, maybe what we have to do is say, let's live with what we've got, and let's work more at paying off our debt.
Last fall, Golden Valley borrowed $65 million in low interest loans directly from the USDA's Rural Utilities Service for infrastructure work and is currently looking for the agency's approval to take on more debt for starting up the Healy Clean Coal Plant. GVEA President and CEO Brian Newton acknowledges Golden Valley's $300 million in debt and 24% debt-to-assets ratio is above average, but he says financing is essential in the power business.
The electric industry is a very highly capitalized business. Members certainly couldn't afford, obviously, if we would try to pay for $100 million projects in current rates. And so we have to make sure that we have financing to be able to spread that cost over 30 years.
Debt is paid back through the rates customers pay for power. But a bigger factor affecting rates is the cost of fuel for power generation. Golden Valley is working on a plan to truck in North Slope natural gas as an alternative to high-cost oil. Newton says startup of the Healy Clean Coal Plant is the only other easy option the oil-dependent utility has for reducing the cost of electricity. The city of Craig is wrapping up work on a new medical building. The new building will house the town's medical clinic, Community Connections, and the State Department of Public Health. KRBD's Deanna Garrison recently toured the new facility with Craig City Administrator John Bowling.
Construction crews are putting the finishing touches on the new 11,500 square foot split level building. Located on 5.5 acres near the Craig High School, City Administrator John Bowling says the facility will replace the city's much smaller and older medical clinic, which he says no longer fits the city's needs.
It's not a hodgepodge of add-ons like the existing clinic building is. That's been added on to at least three times over the course of 25, 30 years, and it really is a hodgepodge of buildings that were put together at different elevations, and so the inside, you've got these ramps inside to try to accommodate the elevation difference. And it's just functionally obsolete in the existing building. This will be an enormous improvement.
In addition to owning the Craig Clinic building, Bowling says the city has been operating the Craig Clinic since the year 2000. He says the clinic portion of the new medical facility will be leased to the same nonprofit that operates Ketchikan General Hospital.
We're not in the clinic business by choice. We're in it sort of by default, and it's important to find an operator who's accustomed to working in the medical field, who knows what they're doing, who's experienced in the field, all of which the city of Craig really isn't.
Peace Health is slated to take over operation of the Craig Clinic on April 19th. The clinic handles approximately 4,100 patient visits annually. Among other things, the clinic will feature 6 exam rooms, a laboratory X-ray room, a small surgical procedure room, and a new patient check-in area.
So this is a Craig Clinic. This is a waiting area. So you come in and check in here, and then we'll send you over to this room to finalize paperwork as you wait to see the doctor.
The facility is slated to be substantially complete by April 7th. Tenants are expected to begin moving in thereafter. Chris Blanc is the project manager for contractor McGraw Construction. He says the project is on schedule and on budget.
I feel real good about this building. It's one of the better ones I've been involved with. It's a nice design and it's going real well.
The building was designed by architectural firm Livingston Sloan. The final price tag of the building will be about $4 million. Two-thirds of the funding came from the Denali Commission. Bowling says the rest of the funding came from the City of Craig and State of Alaska. In Ketchikan, I'm Deanna Garrison.
Japanese climber Masatoshi Kiriaki is back from his 5th attempt at Mount Hunter. The 37-year-old didn't summit, but spent 83 days trying. From member station KTNA, Sue Dio has the story.
Masatoshi Kiriaki became the first Japanese to summit Denali in winter alone. That was 1998. In 2007, he was the first person to summit Foraker in winter alone. This winter, Masa, as he is fondly known, flew up to the Kiltna Glacier on December 28th to attempt a summit of Mount Hunter by himself. It was his 5th attempt at Hunter. Hunter is 3rd in height next to Denali and Foraker, but a more technically challenging mountain. And no, he didn't summit.
I stayed 16 days
for waiting good weather window to make a summit. No chance. So I decided to descend.
No one comes close to Masa as far as winter days spent on the Denali Massif. 664 winter days altogether on Denali, Foraker, and Hunter over the years. He admits he felt like he climbed Hunter a dozen times this winter.
The camp one, I made five trips back and forth. Then the camp one to camp two, 10 trips, almost 10 trips. Then 8 trips. And 4 trips get my highest point.
Any climber knows sometimes you've climbed the mountain twice after ferrying loads between camps. If you pass Masa on the street, you would never guess he's just back from 83 days in the Alaska Range. Much of it at 10,000 feet. He has no sign of frostbite or sunburn. He's thin, but not gaunt. His friends say he showered several times over the last day to wipe out the grime of no shower for 3 months. Each year, his round, spectacled face and slight form shows up in Talkeetna. He is greeted fondly by rangers, by restaurateurs, and anyone else who recognizes his face. He is so humble about his aspirations and about his climbing that few people realize the degree of his expertise. He has earned the respect of climbing rangers because of his cautiousness and the fact that he doesn't want to conquer the mountain. Instead, he says one must pay attention to what Mother Nature is saying.
Keep listening at the Mother Nature's. Always keep listening.
The way Masa approaches the weather and the winter is unusual. Joe Reichert has been a climbing ranger on Denali since the mid-90s and is one of the many who has a great respect.
I just have the utmost admiration for the man because, you know, to me, he's a backcountry traveler and a mountaineer that has incredible respect for the terrain around him, i.e. staying safe and keeping himself as safe as possible in really hazardous terrain, and also a respect for the mountain in terms of he really doesn't leave a mark. Sure, he's got a trail on there, and that trail's pretty well established for the time he's there, but to the best of my knowledge, he brings all his stuff back off the mountain and is a really clean user of the resource, and it just has a spirit that seems to thrive in the wilderness, in that sort of wilderness.
Masa is on his way back to the hustle and bustle of Japan, rush hours, and the millions of people. He will be back, he says, if not next year, then maybe in a few years when his two-year-old daughter, Soko, gets a bit older and his wife, Seiko, allows him to return. Climbing rangers say Hunter will still be here, waiting. In Talkeetna, I'm Sue Dio.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Shane Iverson in Bethel, Ann Hillman in Unalaska, Mike Mason in Dillingham, Ed Ronco in Sitka, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Deanna Garrison in Ketchikan, and Sue Dio in Talkeetna. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Dave Donaldson from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Kristen Spack. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. The Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association was created by the legislature to provide coverage for Alaskans who are denied health insurance due to a high-risk medical condition. For example, a person who has diabetes and has been rejected by an insurance company will be accepted by ACHIA. Ask an insurance broker about ACHIA. Information is also available at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association. Every day, people all over Alaska are discovering how public transportation benefits them, their businesses, and their communities. Public transportation in Alaska provides 7 million rides a year to work, medical appointments, shopping, school, social opportunities, wherever people need to go. With public transportation available, the going is good. Find out more at goodgoingalaska.com. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Mobility Coalition, a nonprofit organization.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.